to take chances and make changes to pursue his dreams. Everyone else I knew always said later. Mystery said now, and that was an intoxicating word to me, because later, every time I'd ever heard it, translated as never. Now is the time, Style, he said when he arrived at my apartment in Santa Monica. Let's build this shit. Sergeant is for losers. I mean, sure, it's better to be a loser who gets laid than one who doesn't, but we're talking about a championship level of game now. I knew he'd understand. According to the books I'd read on cold reading, all human problems fall into one of three areas: health, wealth, and relationships, each of which has an inner and an outer component. For the past year and a half, we'd been focusing solely on relationships. Now it was time to get every cylinder in our lives firing. It was time to join forces to work together for more than just HB-10s. We were greater than the sum of our cocks. The first step to making Project Hollywood a reality was to find a mansion in the Hollywood Hills, preferably with guest bedrooms, a hot tub, and a location near the clubs on Sunset. Next, we needed to hand-select the best in the community to live with us. Perhaps I shouldn't have trusted Mystery again, but this time, I wouldn't let myself be dependent on him. His name wasn't going to be on the lease. Neither would mine, for that matter. We'd find a third party to take the risk and the responsibility. We found that third party living in the Hotel Furama. His name was Papa. His grades had kept him out of law school, so instead he'd enrolled at Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles to study business. The day he moved from Wisconsin to Los Angeles, he dropped his bags off in his hotel room near the airport and took a taxi to my apartment, where a 6-foot-5-inch Mystery was sleeping on my 5-foot-6 couch. The three most influential people in my life, Papa told us as he sat down on the couch at Mystery's feet, have been you two and my father. Papa's hair was now spiked and gelled, and he looked like he'd been working out. I left him to talk with Mystery in my living room while I ran downstairs to a Caribbean food stand to get dinner for everyone. When I returned, Papa was Mystery's manager. Are you sure you know what you're doing? I asked Mystery. I couldn't believe he was going to let a protege turn competitor manage him. Papa likes the business, and he can fill workshops every weekend, Mystery replied. So all I have to do is show up. Papa, in his networking mania, was in contact with nearly every sergeant in North America. He knew all the lair presidents and was on all the seduction mailing lists. With just a few emails and phone calls, he could recruit a dozen students nearly anywhere in the world. It's win-win, Papa insisted. Ever since he'd gotten into the pickup business, that had become Papa's favorite phrase. He was smarter than I'd given him credit for. He was going to become the middleman for the biggest pickup artists in the community. And they were going to let him, because most artists have the same fatal flaw. They're too lazy to deal with anything practical themselves. We never actually invited Papa to join us in Project Hollywood that day. It just happened because he was willing to do the work. There was a Coldwell Banker office across the street from the hotel, and Papa walked in and found us a real estate agent named Joe. Real estate agents don't make much money on rentals, but Papa managed to talk Joe into working for us by promising to teach him the game. I began to understand why Mystery wanted to work with Papa. He was one of us. He was a go-getter. He had initiative. And, unlike Mystery, he was a closer. As a pickup artist, Papa also seemed worthy of Project Hollywood. He'd proven his fearlessness in the field over and over since we'd met him in Toronto, and he would prove himself once more the following day when he picked up Paris Hilton at a taco stand. Chapter 3 MSN Group, Mystery's Lounge. Subject, Field Report, The Seduction of Paris Hilton. Author, Papa. Today I went with Style, Mystery, and our real estate agent to our prospective mansion, Dean Martin's old crib in the Hollywood Hills. I'm in love with the place and can't wait to close the deal. We will be on top of the world, literally and figuratively. When you are in our crib, everything seems perfect. It's a short walk to a popular Mexican fast food restaurant, so we went over there for a late lunch. After ordering food, we found a table outside. Suddenly, our agent leaned over to me and whispered that Paris Hilton had just walked into the restaurant. I got up, walked into the restaurant, and saw a hot blonde chick getting salsa. So I thought, salsa sounds good to me. I've been gearing my game up for this moment, and now it was time to take what I deserved. So I walked over to her side and pretended like I was just at the salsa bar by coincidence. I helped myself to some salsa and then looked over my right shoulder at her and started the conversation with Styles' Jealous Girlfriend opener. Papa: hey, I need a female opinion on something. Paris smiles and looks up. Okay. Papa: would you date a guy who was still friends with his ex-girlfriend? Paris: yeah, I think so. Sure. I started to walk away, then turned back and continued the conversation. Papa: actually, this is a two-part question. Paris smiles and giggles. Papa: imagine you were dating a guy who was still friends with his ex-girlfriend, and you were going to move in with him, but he had a drawer with pictures of his ex-girlfriend. Not nudie pictures or anything, just regular pictures and some letters. Paris: ooh, I would so get rid of them. I would put them in a box. I cut her off and continued with the opener. Papa: do you think it's unreasonable for her to want him to get rid of those pictures? Paris: oh, for sure. I dated a guy who did that, and I tossed them. Papa: wow. The reason why I asked was because I have a friend in the same situation, and she burned them. Paris: yes, that's what I should have done. Smiles. Paris finished getting her salsa, then took her salsa containers and started to walk away. Papa: hey, you know, you look like a little cartoon version of Britney Spears. Oh, maybe it's just your teeth. Paris put her salsa container back on the table, looked at me, and smiled. Then I told her Styles' C's versus U's routine. Papa: yeah, you have Britney teeth. Well, that's what my ex-girlfriend said. I mean, she has a theory that girls who have teeth in a wide C shape, like Britney Spears, are perceived as good girls, no matter how many guys they hook up with. You have the same kind of C-shaped teeth. Paris, excited and smiling: oh yeah? Papa: hey, I mean, just look at the smiles of the cover girls on magazines. They have the same kind of teeth. Well, at least that's what she said. She even got surgery done to her teeth because she had U-shaped teeth, like Christina Aguilera. She said U-shaped teeth are perceived as unfriendly, and that's why Christina Aguilera has the bad girl reputation and Britney Spears doesn't. Paris smiles: wow. We walked to the counter and she grabbed her food. I acted as if I were going to leave, but don't think I'm going to leave Paris without proper game. She had her food and she was about to exit the restaurant, so I had to keep her there. I looked over my shoulder and continued the conversation. Papa: I have an intuition about you. Paris: what? She put her food down and looked at me. Papa: you know, I can tell you deep insights about yourself just by asking three questions. Paris: oh yeah? Papa: yeah, here, come over to this table. Paris: okay, sure. I sat down at a nearby table, and she placed her food on the table and sat down across from me. When she sat down, she smiled. I knew I was set, and that it was time to work solid game. For the next 15 minutes, we shared some stories about Hollywood and talked about commonalities. I did some qualifying, gave her some speed seduction patterns, and told her some socially proofed higher value stories. Papa: well, my friend taught me this fascinating visualization technique called the cube. He's over there right now, and we just finished shopping for a house over there, pointing in the direction of the Hollywood Hills. I've been living in a hotel for the last 10 weeks. Ugh. Paris: oh yeah? Which one? Papa: the Furama. Paris nods: yeah, I live right up the street on King's Road. Papa: cool, I'll be your neighbor. I'm moving into a house on Londonderry. It's a great place, and I already have so much heart for it. My friend Style and I are talking about making it a great place for after parties. Paris: cool. Papa: okay, are you ready for the cube? Paris: yes, sure. Smiles. Papa: great. Imagine you're driving in the desert and you see a cube. How big is the cube? Paris: it's really big. Papa: how big is that? Paris: as big as a hotel. Though I knew who she was, I didn't give it away and acknowledged she was a Hilton. Papa: interesting. Okay, so what color is it? Paris: pink. After I finished the cube, she asked me my name. Papa: Papa, what's your name? Paris: Paris. Papa: rock on. I feel like we have so much to talk about. We should definitely party it up together sometime. Paris. Yes, we should. Papa. Here. I gave her a piece of paper and a pen. She wrote down her first and last name, and then handed it to me, expecting to impress me and get a wow response. But I didn't give her any response, as if I had no idea who she was. Then I handed it back to her. Papa. Here. Paris. Okay, write it down right here? Papa. Yes. Paris. This is my cell phone. Papa. Cool. Paris. Yeah, we should definitely meet up. Papa. Yeah, rock on. I'll see ya, kid. I walked back to see the boys at the table outside and explained what happened. This rocks. I know that this is the way things are going to be. It just makes sense that I would roll with Paris Hilton when I'm in Project Hollywood. Mystery, this is my set. So hands off when Paris comes by the crib to see Papa. Chapter 4. Every word Papa told Paris Hilton had come from me. The jealous girlfriend opener, the C-shaped versus U-shaped smiles routine. Even his delivery of the cube was the exact same as what he'd recorded at his first workshop with Mystery and me, down to the way he said interesting and cool. He was a great robot, and he had just outperformed his programmer. We walked back to the house to meet the owners and sign the paperwork. The former home of Dean Martin, and later the comedian Eddie Griffin, the Rat Pack crib was just above Mel's Diner on Sunset Boulevard. The living room looked like a ski lodge. There was a fireplace, a sunken dance floor, a 30-foot-high ceiling, a massive wood inlay wall mural, and a large bar in the corner. The space could easily hold a few hundred people for seminars and parties. There were two bedrooms off the living room on the ground floor. Outside each of these rooms was a staircase leading up to another bedroom, and then there was a small maid's room off the kitchen. The crown jewel of the house was a multi-tiered backyard. On one level, there were two patios shaded by palm and lemon trees. On the second level, there was a large brick terrace with a peanut-shaped pool, a jacuzzi, a dining area, and a working barbecue and refrigerator. Beyond it lay a landscaped hill with a path winding up to a small, secluded deck at the top of the property. From there, we could see the glittering lights and 10-story movie billboards of Hollywood. The place was a chick magnet. There was no way we could fail here. Papa put his name down on the lease. This, in addition to paying the larger of the rents, earned him the right to the master bedroom, which came equipped with a raised platform intended for a bed, picture windows, and a fireplace. The bathroom was decked out with a glass-encased circular shower, two walk-in closets, and a whirlpool bathtub built for three. The possibilities were limitless. Papa had visions of renting the house for after-Grammy parties, movie premieres, and corporate events. He no longer sarged girls when he went out. Instead, he sarged promoters and celebrities, trying to make connections for Project Hollywood after-parties. He even used speed seduction and NLP tactics to try and hypnotize promoters and millionaires into investing in the house. In his spare time, he made bids for tanning beds, movie projectors, pool tables, and stripper poles on eBay. He wanted to make Project Hollywood a place Paris Hilton would want to come every weekend to party. There were still two bedrooms that needed to be filled, so we issued a call for roommates on Mystery's Lounge. The response was terrifying. Everybody wanted in. Step 8. Pump buying temperature. Chapter 1. The first night, we all sat in the jacuzzi from midnight until the skin hung loosely from our bodies, gazing at the palm trees of our new place and the lights of the Hollywood clubs we would soon descend upon. Mystery sang the entire soundtrack of Jesus Christ Superstar to the night sky. Papa told us about his plan to use the house for A-list Hollywood parties. And Herbal, one of our new roommates, served watermelon drinks from his blender. There were no girls, and we didn't need any to validate us. Tonight, it was just the boys. We had done it. Project Hollywood was not just a fantasy anymore. "We'll make the house famous with our public exploits," Mystery predicted as we all sat there with smiles plastered to our faces. "People will drive by and say, 'This was the home of the Hollywood celebrities, Style, Mystery, Papa, and Herbal. They built their careers here and had parties that were the envy of the world.'" Herbal was our fourth roommate. He was a tall, pale, even-tempered 22-year-old Pua from Austin, who peacocked by painting his nails silver and wearing all-white clothing. Like the rest of us, he was a reformed geek. But he owned a house in Texas, a Mercedes-Benz S600, a Rolex, an office on Sunset Boulevard that he never went to, and a robot vacuum cleaner. They were impressive holdings for someone his age. He had earned them in some kind of shady casino operation, in which he hired others to gamble for him. In his spare time, which was basically all his time, he explored caves, recorded extremely catchy rap songs, and surfed the internet for unusual items to buy and then never use. Mystery insisted that everyone in the house have an identity, so we had a magician, a writer, a gambler, and a businessman. It was a combination that would prove more dramatic than the most sensationalist reality show. A few days later, Papa moved a fifth roommate, Playboy, into the maid's room. Playboy was a party promoter from New York who earned my admiration when he told me he'd worked for the Merce Cunningham Dance Company. He was genetically good-looking, tall and slender with thick black hair, but he had a bad habit of wearing long artsy scarves and pants pulled up to his belly button. He had quit his job to move in with us, so Papa hired him to work for Real Social Dynamics in exchange for rent. Then there was Xenius. He lived in a tent in the backyard. Xenius was a short, stocky, fresh-faced college soccer player from Colorado who had begged to live in the house. He said he'd sleep anywhere and do anything. So Papa pitched a tent for him, asked him to pay for utilities and house cleaning, and brought him into the Real Social Dynamics fold as an intern. For the first 2 weeks, all we did was marvel at the house. We'd done it. We had beaten the system. We had the most desirable location in West Hollywood, and we had lucked out with our roommates. Herbal had already scheduled a pickup artist summit, the first annual, to take place in our house in a month. At our initial house meeting, we established a structure for Project Hollywood, putting Papa in charge of social activities and Herbal in charge of finances. Then we laid down the rules. No unapproved house guests for more than a month. Anyone conducting a seminar in the living room has to give the house fund a 10% kickback, and no sergeant women another Pua has brought into the house. All these rules would soon be broken. I initially enjoyed living with roommates, leaving my introverted writer's world and being part of a whole that was greater than the sum of its parts. Every morning, I'd wake up and see Herbal and Mystery pitching quarters into an ice bucket in the middle of the living room or jumping off a stepladder into a pile of pillows. They were like two kids in search of a playground. "I have a feeling that you and I are going to become great friends," Mystery told Herbal one morning. When Playboy threw our first house party, 500 people showed up. We were setting a great example, maybe not to the neighbors, but at least to the community. Within a month, we had franchised. A group of Puas moved into Herbal's old house and christened it Project Austin. Some of our former students in San Francisco rented a 5-bedroom house in Chinatown and held pickup seminars in their living room, giving birth to Project San Francisco. Several college students in Perth, Australia, found a house together and started Project Perth, approaching 100 women in their first 3 days on campus. And 4 Puas Mystery and I had trained in Sydney rented a beach apartment with an elevator that opened directly into a club below them. This was Project Sydney. Nobody had understood the potential of this whole pickup community, the bonding power of dudes talking about chicks. We had manicures, we had mansions, and we had game. We were ready to infect the world like a disease. Chapter 2. In my first month at Project Hollywood, entirely by accident, my sexual reality burst open. Just as Mystery's first workshop had opened my eyes to what was possible in a bar, this latest turn of events opened my eyes to what was possible in bed. And it all happened because Herbal wouldn't let me sleep, for a week straight. "Have you ever heard of a sleep diet?" Herbal asked as we sat at Mel's Diner one morning. "I discovered it on the internet." In his free time, Herbal discovered a lot of things on the internet. A limousine on eBay he wanted to get for the house, dirt cheap, 1,000 thread count sheets for our beds, a new and better way to fold shirts, and a business that sold penguins as pets, though when he ordered a penguin for the house, he learned that it was a joke website. "Basically," he continued, "it's a way to train your body to survive on just 2 hours of sleep a day." "How's that?" "They did scientific research, and instead of sleeping for 8 hours every night, what you do is nap for 20 minutes every 4 hours." I was tempted. Having 6 extra hours in the day would give me time to write more, play more, read more, exercise more, go out more, and learn all the other PUA skills I never had time to. Is there a catch? Well, Herbal said, it takes about 10 days to adjust to the schedule, and it's not easy. But once you make it over the hump, the naps become totally natural. People say they have more energy, though they also find themselves wanting to drink a lot of juice for some reason. Just like most things in life, I didn't hesitate to say yes. I had nothing to lose if it didn't work, except 10 days of sleep. We stocked up on video games and DVDs and instructed our housemates to help keep us disciplined. Oversleeping or missing even one nap would throw off the entire experiment and we'd have to start over. As an extra incentive to stay awake, I invited girls to the house each day. I was seeing about 10 different girls now. They were what the PUAs call MLTRs, multiple long-term relationships. Unlike AFCs, I never lied to these girls. They all knew I was seeing other people. And, to my surprise, even if it didn't make all of them happy, none of them left me. One of the most important realizations I'd had in the game came from a spiritual self-improvement book that Ross Jeffries had recommended, Mastering Your Hidden Self. It taught me the idea that the world is what you think it is. In other words, if you believe that you need to have a harem, and having a harem is normal, women will agree to it. It's simply your reality. However, if you want a harem, but secretly feel that it's cheating and unethical, you'll never have one. The only woman who wasn't entirely comfortable with this arrangement was a short, curvy, effervescent Spanish girl named Isabel, who had a habit of twitching her nose like a rat in search of cheese. I only sleep with one person at a time, she constantly told me, and I wish you'd do the same. On the fourth day of the sleep experiment, I invited Hia, the indie rocker who cheated on her boyfriend to sleep with me, over to keep me awake. She was tiny, like a chihuahua, and wore large black spectacles. Yet there was something profoundly sexy about her, as if she were just one glass slipper away from becoming a princess. Potential for beauty is as attractive to most men as actual beauty. When women go out with their hair, makeup, nails, and clothing meticulously arranged, it's generally for the benefit of other women. Men, though they certainly enjoy it, don't require a fashion magazine grooming from a stranger. We have active imaginations. We are constantly stripping every woman naked, as well as dressing her up to see if she meets our feminine ideal. Hia, then, was a girl who other women ignored, yet every man desired. We saw her potential. When Hia arrived, Herbal and I greeted her at the door with bloodshot eyes, unshaven faces, and dragging feet. The sleep diet was taking its toll. Our manners and maturity were the first to go. We brought her into Herbal's room, sat her down on the floor, and played video games on the Xbox for an hour to keep ourselves awake. When the doorbell rang again, I trudged to answer it and found Isabel standing on the doorstep. I was dancing with some friends at Barfly, she said, nose a wiggle. So since I was in the neighborhood, I thought I'd drop by. You know I hate drop-bys. I had always told my MLTRs to call before coming over, in case something like this happened. I sighed and let her in. It seemed rude to turn her away. But good to see you, I guess. I brought her into Herbal's room and introduced everyone. Isabel sat on the floor next to Hia. Her intuition tingled. She looked Hia up and down, then asked, "So how do you know style?" I had a feeling this wasn't a casual visit, but a sneak attack. So I left them alone in the room and went to find Mystery. I was too tired for drama. "Dude," I said, "I'm screwed. Isabel and Hia are catfighting. How do I get rid of one of them?" "I've got a better idea," he said. "You should threesome them." "You're joking." "No. One of my students was telling me about a technique he once used to get a threesome started. You should try it. Just suggest an innocent three-way massage. See what happens." "Sounds like a gamble." I didn't want another disaster, like the porcelain twins' bathtub incident. "You're not gambling. You're taking a risk. Gambling is completely random. A risk is calculated. If two girls are at your house listening to you and giving you IOIs, the odds are in your favor that something will happen." Mystery could be very persuasive. Throughout this whole pickup process, I'd been trying on clothes and behaviors I'd never thought were me. Some of them worked, so I kept them. Others didn't, so I discarded them. I decided to take a chance. I was willing to risk losing them. I dragged my feet back to Herbal's room. "Hey, guys," I told the girls between yawns. "I have to show you these home movies that Mystery and I made. They're hilarious." Inspired by our video of Carly and Caroline in Montreal, Mystery had started filming our trips and adventures, editing them into humorous 10-minute shorts. I brought them up to my room. I had no chairs there, of course, just a bed. So we all lay on the comforter while I showed them the video Mystery and I had made in Montreal. As it ended, I steadied my nerves and took the risk. "I just experienced the most amazing thing," I told the girls. I went to San Diego and hung out with my friend Steve P., who's a guru and a shaman, and he had two of his students perform what he called a dual induction massage on me. Their hands were moving in perfect synchronization on my back. And because your conscious mind can't process all those movements, it disconnects and you feel like there are thousands of hands massaging you. It was amazing. If you describe anything with enthusiasm and congruence, people will want to try it, especially if you don't give them the opportunity to say no. "Get on your back," I told Isabel. Since she was the girl most likely to be jealous, I knew we'd need to massage her first. I kneeled on her right side and positioned Hia on the left, telling her to follow my movements exactly. When we finished kneading her back, I pulled off my shirt and lay on my stomach. The girls positioned themselves on either side of my back and began massaging me, tentatively at first, then with more confidence. As the two of them leaned over me, their hands tracing circles around my shoulder blades, I could feel the energy in the room begin to change. The sexual nature of the situation was beginning to dawn on them, if it hadn't already. This was quite possibly going to work. When it was Hia's turn, she took off her shirt and lay on her stomach. This time, I made the massage more erotic, rubbing her inner thigh and the sides of her breasts. After her massage, Hia remained on her stomach while Isabel and I kneeled over her. This was the deciding moment. I had to escalate. I was so nervous, my hands started shaking, just like at my disastrous high school lunch with Elisa. I pulled Isabel's face close to mine and began making out with her. As we kissed, I lowered our bodies until we were practically lying on top of Hia, who was trapped under us. Then I turned Hia's face toward me and began kissing her. She responded. It was working. I gently pulled Isabel into the kiss. Once Hia and Isabel's lips met, the spark of sexual tension that had hung in the room during the massage exploded. They were all over each other, as if they'd been wanting to do this all along. But they hadn't. They'd been bitter rivals less than an hour earlier. I didn't understand it, but then again, I didn't need to. Hia removed Isabel's shirt, and we both began sucking on her breasts. We pulled off her pants and began licking up her thighs until her back began to arch. I pulled off Isabel's panties while Hia crawled behind me and struggled with my pants. As I helped her with a button fly, I glanced at the clock. It was 2 a.m. My heart froze. It had been 4 hours since my last nap. I couldn't just go to sleep in the middle of the first threesome of my life. But if I didn't, the last 4 days of sleep deprivation would have been in vain. "Hey," I told them, "I hate to do this, but I need to take my 20-minute nap now. You can join me if you want." With Isabel on one side and Hia on the other, I fell asleep instantly. I dreamed that the streets were water and I was swimming through them. When the alarm went off, I pulled both girls into me and we began fooling around again. But this time Isabel pulled away. "This is weird," she said. "It's totally weird," I replied. "I've been thinking the same thing, but it's a new experience, so I'm just going with it." She nodded and smiled and pulled my boxer briefs off. Both women put their hands around me, and I leaned back and watched. I wanted to keep the image in my head for future use. However, when Hia began to give me a blowjob, Isabel's body tensed. I remembered something Rick H. had said about threesomes at David D'Angelo's seminar. The experience has to be about your girlfriend's pleasure, not yours. She has to be the lead sled dog, as he put it, and your main objective is to make sure she's always comfortable and feeling good. "Is this making you uncomfortable?" I asked the lead sled dog. "A little," Isabel said. I guided Hia's head back up, and we lay together, talking and fooling around, until my next nap. I didn't have sex with Hia that night. I knew Isabel wouldn't be able to handle seeing me inside another woman. This had already been a big step for her, and for me. The next night, I was even more exhausted. Herbal and I sat in the living room, watching Dangerous Liaison to stay awake, but we kept drifting into daydreams that lasted fractions of a second. These are called microsleeps. Our bodies needed rest so badly that they were sneaking naps whenever we weren't paying attention. "The sleep diet was a terrible idea," I told Herbal. "Just stick with it," he said. It'll pay off in the long run. Fortunately, Nadia was coming over soon. She was another one of my MLTRs, the sexy librarian I had met during my personals experiment. She showed up after a Suicide Girls burlesque show at the Knitting Factory, accompanied by a girl named Barbara, whose black bangs reminded me of Betty Page. I poured them a drink and we sat on a couch together. Though Barbara had a boyfriend, I noticed that she was very touchy-feely with Nadia. She seemed to have a crush on her, so I thought I'd give her the opportunity to act on it. I excused myself from my much-needed nap. I dreamed I was stranded naked in an endless snow-covered field, and then called them up to my room to watch my home movies. Afterward, I initiated the dual induction massage, and to my surprise, it worked again. The moment they started kissing, the girls devoured each other, just like Isabel and Hia had. So it hadn't been just a lucky accident the night before. Unlike Isabel, Nadia was a lead sled dog with no jealousy issues. When I fucked Nadia, Barbara knelt behind me and licked me. I wanted to wait and fuck Barbara too, but there would be no waiting. What was occurring was so far beyond my wildest expectations when I'd first joined the community that I just lost it. I couldn't hold out any longer, and I never got to have sex with Barbara. This is what the Pooahs call a quality problem. Over the last year and a half, I'd spent a lot of time working on my appearance, my energy, my attitude, and my state. Yet now, when all those qualities were at their lowest, when I looked and felt like shit, I'd had the most sexually decadent 2 days of my life. There was a lesson here. The less you appear to be trying, the better you do. The next day, Herbal and I sat in the living room with a bowl of ice cubes, which we rubbed on ourselves every few minutes to shock our systems into staying awake. The sleep adjustment process was proving to be more difficult than we had imagined. I began to worry that we were wasting our time. After all, this whole sleep diet hadn't even been scientifically proven. After another 2 nap cycles, my head began to hurt, and my eyes refused to raise any higher than half-mast. We bathed in cold water, we slapped ourselves in the face, we ran around the living room chasing each other with brooms. But nothing worked. When I felt my teeth to check my braces, I knew I'd passed over the edge of reason. I hadn't worn braces since junior high. "I'm going to sleep," Herbal finally said. "We can't," I told him. "If you go to sleep, I won't make it by myself." "Watch out for the toothpicks," he said. We both started cracking up. He just had a micro sleep. Dreams and reality were blurring. "Just try to make it through one more sleep cycle," I told him. But after the next 20-minute nap, I couldn't get Herbal out of bed. He refused to even open his eyes. I couldn't continue on my own, so I dragged my feet upstairs and drifted into the sweetest slumber of my life. And though I had failed the sleep experiment, at least I'd reached a new plateau in my game. I know I should be humble about the dual induction massage and pretend like it was another step down a degrading path, but discovering the secret to threesomes was like finding the Rosetta Stone of pickup. Once the dual induction massage routine was developed and shared, Pooahs all over the world started having threesomes. It was like breaking the 3-minute mile. The dual induction massage would ultimately ensure my ranking as the number one Pooah on Thundercat's list for a second year running. Project Hollywood was already a success. Chapter 3. And then Tyler Durden arrived. He looked like he'd been spray tanning. "I know I didn't make a good impression in L.A., he said. He shook my hand. He even looked me in the eye for a microsecond. He wore a trendy black and white shirt with ropes hanging from the ribcage area like a corset. It wasn't peacocky. It was the kind of shirt I would have bought. "Social intelligence is something that hasn't come easy for me," he continued. I think he was apologizing. "I'm still working at it. I can come across as self-centered when I slip. Not cool. I suppose I should be more equipped to, as Mystery always tells me, learn how to sarge guys." It was humble of him. He'd done dozens of workshops since we'd met, and I'd been watching his progress online. His students said he now rivaled Mystery in his pickup prowess. I was willing to give him a second chance. Maybe he really had done some serious work on himself. That's the idea this community was predicated on, after all. Since we would both be going to Las Vegas to wing one of Mystery's workshops that weekend, I was looking forward to seeing if the stories about his prowess in the field were true. Tyler slung his bag over his shoulder and walked up to Papa's room. Between Papa's newfound passion for business and Tyler Durden's quest to be the community's best pickup artist, It made a perfect team. Our house now had the best Puas in the game. Of course, to the best of my recollection, Tyler Durden had never been approved as a resident. There wasn't room for anyone else. However, Papa had taken it upon himself to invite him, converting one of his bathroom closets into an extra bedroom by putting a mattress on the floor. We didn't have furniture yet, just a collection of 50 throw pillows we'd bought to cover the sunken dance floor. That night, Playboy rigged his movie projector to show movies on the ceiling, and we all lay in the pillow pit and watched Carnal Knowledge. Afterward, Tyler Durden turned to me. "Your archive has been really influential in my game," he said. My collected posts on the seduction newsgroups had been compiled into a large text file and posted online along with the archives of Mystery and Ross Jeffries. A lot of my best shit I took from there. It was hard to get out of a conversation with Tyler Durden. Whenever he wasn't playing the game, he was talking about it. "I've been experimenting with telling people I'm you in the field," Tyler said. "What do you mean?" "I tell them I'm Neil Strauss, and that I write for Rolling Stone." "And does it get results?" The idea of this pasty little freak running around telling people he was me turned my stomach, but I tried to act nonchalant. "It depends. Sometimes they think I'm lying. Sometimes I get girls saying, 'Oh my god, we should hang out instantly.' And other girls, if you tell them that shit, you're blown out because it looks like you're bragging. Let me tell you something. I've been writing for over a decade, and it hasn't gotten me laid once. Writers aren't cool or sexy. There's no social proof to be gained by hanging out with a writer. At least, that's been my experience. Why do you think I joined the community? But I'm flattered that you tried." That weekend, Tyler Durden, Mystery, and I went to Las Vegas. Papa had booked 10 students for Mystery, which was pretty good for a 6-person workshop. We took them to the Hard Rock Casino. Generally, on the first night, the students watched the instructors work. As a Pua, Tyler Durden had improved drastically since I'd last seen him in Los Angeles, where he didn't talk to any women. When I noticed him sarging a bachelorette party, I inched closer to listen. He was talking about Mystery. "See that tall guy in the top hat?" he was telling them. "He needs a lot of attention, so he'll say hurtful things to people just to make them like him. So humor him, because he needs help." He was giving away Mystery's game, neutralizing his negs. "He likes doing magic tricks to get people to accept him," he continued. "So just be nice and pretend like you're excited. He does a lot of children's birthday parties." Now he was neutralizing Mystery's value-demonstrating routines. After Tyler Durden left the set, I asked him what he was doing. "Papa and I have developed a lot of new techniques to blow you and Mystery out," he said. "So what do you say about me?" I asked, trying to pretend I wasn't disturbed. Tyler Durden started laughing. "We say their style. He's actually 45 years old, but he looks pretty young to me. He's so cute. He's like a little Elmer Fudd." I stared at him in disbelief. He was amogging his fellow Puas. It was diabolical. "You can get me," Tyler said. "You can say I look like the Pillsbury Doughboy." I choked back my disgust and thought, what would Tom Cruise do? "But I don't want to get you, man," I replied, keeping my own counsel and giving him a big smile like I thought it was all very funny. "Here's the difference between you and me. I like to surround myself with people who are better than me, because I enjoy being pushed and challenged. You, on the other hand, like to become the best person in the room by eliminating anyone who's better than you." "Yeah, maybe you're right," he said. Later, I would realize I was only half right. Tyler Durden did like to eliminate competition, but not before he'd squeezed every piece of useful information out of them. For the rest of the weekend, whenever I talked to a person, male or female, Tyler Durden was hovering behind me, listening to every word. I could see him thinking, trying to figure out the rules and patterns behind everything I said that kept me dominant in a group. He had studied my archive. He was studying my personality. Soon he would no doubt know more about me than I did. And then, as with the Amogs in Leicester Square, he turned my own words and mannerisms against me. At the end of the night, I saw a two-set sitting at the bar in the Peacock Lounge. A tall, creepy, bespectacled brunette with incongruously large fake breasts and a short blonde tomboy with a white beret and a small, thick, curvy body. "That blonde girl's a porn star," Mystery said. He was the expert. "Her name's Faith. That's your set." Despite the year and a half I'd spent in the community, despite being supposedly the best, I still got intimidated when I saw a beautiful woman. My old AFC self was always threatening to snap back, whispering that everything I'd learned was wrong that I was bowing before false gods, that all this game talk was just mental masturbation. But I pushed myself to enter the set anyway, just to prove that little AFC voice in the back of my head wrong. As soon as I opened my mouth, I went into autopilot. I opened with Jealous Girlfriend. I gave myself a time constraint. I negged the target about her hoarse voice. I did the best friends test. C-shaped smiles versus U-shaped smiles. ESP experiment. "There's so much I can learn from you," Faith said. "We love you," gushed her creepy friend. They were eating out of my hands. I'm a nerdy Elmer Fudd spouting bullshit tests I made up, and these two girls, whose collective breasts weigh more than me, were staring at me rapt. I had nothing to be afraid of. No guy out there had the tools we did. I must kill off that inner AFC. When will he die? I signaled to Mystery to wing the obstacle. As he sat next to the creepy girl, I went back on autopilot. Evolution phase shift. Smell. Pull hair. Bite arm. Bite neck. "How do you rate yourself as a kisser on a scale of 1 to 10? Suddenly, Faith jumped out of her seat. "I'm getting too turned on," she said. "I have to leave." I couldn't figure out if she was just giving me an excuse because I had made a mistake at some point in the Sarge, or if I was really that good. I approached a nearby set, two hippie girls on a bender, and was in with them instantly. 10 minutes into our conversation, however, Faith returned, grabbed my hand, and said, "Let's go to the bathroom." We walked into the restroom on the side of the Peacock Lounge, and she lowered the toilet seat and sat me down on it. As she unbuttoned my pants, she said, "You so turn me on, intellectually and sexually." "I know," I told her. "How?" "I felt our connection all night. Even when I was talking to those two other girls, I saw you looking at me." She kneeled on the floor, circled her hand around my limp father of thousands, and lowered her mouth over it. But I couldn't get hard. I was overwhelmed. I stood up and pushed her roughly against the wall. I circled my hands around her throat and made out with her, as I'd seen Sin do to women in his house when I was still in AFC. Then I pulled her pants down, sat her on the toilet seat, fingered her, and went down on her. She arched her back, fluttered her eyelids, and moaned, as if she were about to come. But instead, she suddenly switched positions and went down on me again. "I want you to come into my mouth," she said. I still couldn't get hard. This had never happened to me before. I mean, I'm hard right now as I'm remembering this. "I want to be inside you," I told her, in a last-ditch effort to get my blood flowing to the right place. She stood up and turned around. I pulled a condom out of my pocket and thought about every beautiful woman I had approached that night. I started to get a little harder. She sat down on me, her back against my stomach, which was the worst position for a semi-erect dick to reach around. As soon as I was partway inside her, I went soft again. I couldn't figure out if it was the two Jack and Cokes I drank that night, the lack of foreplay, the intimidation factor of being with a porn star, or the fact that I'd masturbated earlier that day. When we walked out of the bathroom, half the workshop students were standing there waiting for a lay report. One of the hippies I'd been talking to before went to the bathroom and emerged afterward with my condom wrapper and a Kleenex. Evidently, I'd left it on the floor, and she felt obliged to show it around. Everyone was celebrating a feat that hadn't actually happened. I couldn't look Faith in the eye afterward. I had built myself up as such a mysterious, fascinating, sexually powerful guy. And then, in the moment of truth, the lies had come crashing down, revealing a skinny, bald guy with a limp dick. Chapter 4. On the last night of the Las Vegas workshop, Tyler Durden picked up a hostess named Stacy at the Hard Rock Cafe. She was a vampirish blonde who listened to nu metal. When her shift ended, Stacy met us at the casino and brought along her roommate, Tammy, a quiet beauty with a touch of baby fat and a scent of grape bubblicious. I was wearing a ridiculous snakeskin suit. Mystery was dressed in a top hat, flight goggles, 6-inch platform boots, black latex pants, and a black t-shirt with a scrolling red digital sign that said Mystery on it. Even for Vegas, he looked like a freak. Within minutes, Tyler Durden was amogging him to Stacy. "He wears these weird signs and people laugh at him," he told her. "I always tell him he doesn't need to do that for people to accept him." The students fanned the room to talk to women as I leaned against the bar and watched them. After a while, Stacy sidled up next to me. She had been watching me lead the workshop, and from sheer social proof, lead the men and you lead the women, she had become interested. As we talked, she held eye contact with me. She played with her hair. She looked for excuses to touch my arm. She leaned in when I leaned back. All the IOIs were there. I could feel the air around us tingle, as it always does when a potential kiss is accumulating energy. I knew it was wrong. She was Tyler Durden's girl. There's a PUA code of ethics. The first one to approach a set gets to game the target until either she submits or he gives up. But a PUA also doesn't AMOG his wing. If Tyler Durden was going to tell girls I was Elmer Fudd, then Elmer Fudd was going to hunt his rabbit. I stroked her hair. She smiled. Would she like to kiss me? She would. We did. Then a shock of orangey blonde hair appeared in the periphery of my vision. It was Mr. Heatmiser, and he was pissed. Come with me, Tyler Durden said, grabbing her arm. I started to apologize. What I had done was wrong, and I knew it logically. But when that bubble of connection and passion builds around you and a girl, logic goes out the window, and instinct takes over. I had fucked up. Sure, he'd been AMOGging me, but two wrongs don't make a right. I felt like shit. He would never forgive me for making out with his target. Chapter 5. The point was women. The result was men. Instead of models in bikinis, lounging by the Project Hollywood pool all day, we had pimply teenagers, bespectacled businessmen, tubby students, lonely millionaires, struggling actors, frustrated taxi drivers, and computer programmers. Lots of computer programmers. They walked in our door AFCs, they came out players. Every Friday when they arrived, Mystery or Tyler Durden stood in front of the pillow pit and taught them pretty much the same openers, body language tips, and value demonstrating routines. On Saturday afternoon, they all went shopping on Melrose. They bought the same 4-inch platform new rock boots and black and white striped shirts with bits of rope hanging from the sides. They bought the same rings, necklaces, hats, and sunglasses. They went to the tanning salon. We were breeding an army. At night, they descended on the Sunset Strip, a swarm of player bees. Even when the seminar and workshop ended, students lingered in the clubs on Sunset for months afterward, working on their game. You could spot them from behind by the matching boots and the rope dangling from their shirts. They clustered in groups, prowling for open sets and sending in emissaries to say, "Hey, I need to get a female opinion on something." Even on nights when there weren't workshops, badly peacock guys from a 100-mile radius gathered in our living room before going out. At 2:30 a.m., they reconvened at the house, either accompanied by drunk, giggling girls from Orange County who they brought to the jacuzzi, the terrace, the closets, or the pillow pit, or they returned empty-handed and broke down their approaches until dawn. They couldn't stop talking about this stuff. "Maybe the reason I'm not getting into a lot of relationships," Tyler Durden said one afternoon as he plopped down in the booth at Mel's next to me, "is that I don't like oral sex." Giving or receiving? Both. That's when I realized that Tyler Durden wasn't in the community to get laid. He wasn't motivated by sex. He was motivated by power. Papa's motivations were harder to determine. Originally, he was in the game for girls. When we moved into Project Hollywood, he envisioned turning his room into a high-tech sultan's lair, with a harem just a phone call away. He talked about getting a bed like a throne, a high-end home entertainment center, a bar next to the fireplace, and drapery hanging from the ceiling. But that's not what his room became. When I returned from Mel's with Tyler, Mystery was in Papa's room arguing. "You're giving Tyler Durden more students than you're giving me," Mystery was saying. "I'm trying to make this win-win for everyone," Papa protested. The expression seemed hollower every time he used it. As I looked around his room, I was appalled. There was hardly any furniture, just sleeping bags and pillows strewn across the floor. Women have one word for bedrooms like this: deal breaker. "Who's living here?" I asked. "Some of the RSD guys," he replied, using the acronym for Real Social Dynamics. "How many people?" "Well, right now, Tyler Durden and Sick Boy are in the closets in my bathroom, and I have 3 boot camp students sleeping in the room. Well, if anyone's staying more than a month, they need to be approved, like we agreed at the house meeting. There are enough guys in the house as it is." "Outstanding," Papa said. If they're using the resources of the house, they should be paying, Mystery said. Papa looked at him blankly. I can't talk to that guy, Mystery threw up his hands and complained to me. He just sits there and stares at you and says outstanding. He's so fucking passive. It's not true, Papa said. You think you can push me around because I was a former student. I'd never seen Papa upset before. He didn't get loud, like most people. Instead, his voice became very stuffy. Somewhere inside, there was a living, breathing, emotional person waiting to be set free. After that day, Papa stopped entering the house through the front door. Instead, in order to avoid Mystery, he walked all the way around the back to the patio and climbed a staircase that led to a door in his bathroom. All his guests did the same. Chapter 6. My father died when I was 40, and I couldn't find a way to cry. Not because I didn't love him, not because he didn't try. The lyrics boomed through the living room. Mystery was lying in the pillow pit with his computer on his chest. He was playing the song Randall Hunting Knife by Guy Clark over and over. He seemed to be in need of attention, so I walked over and gave him some. My dad died, he said. His voice was flat and even. It was hard to tell if he was sad or not. It's about time. It happened very quickly. He had another stroke, and then he died at 10 a.m. today. I sat down next to him and listened to him talk. He was a passive observer of himself, analytically deconstructing his emotions as he felt them. Even though I was ready for it, it's strange. It's like when Johnny Cash died. You knew it was going to happen, but it was still a shock. Mystery had hated his dad his whole life and wished death on him countless times. But now that it had happened, he didn't know how to feel. He seemed confused that he felt a little sad, despite himself. The only times we ever bonded were when a hot woman came on TV, he said. Then he'd look at me, and I'd look at him, and we'd quietly appreciate it together. A few days later, we hosted the first annual Pickup Artist Summit at our house. Puas from around the world flew in to speak, and several hundred RAFCs, recovering average frustrated chumps, gathered in our living room to hear them. Our housemates Playboy and Xanius, who Papa and Tyler Durden had been training to become instructors, opened the proceedings. As Playboy discussed body language, I thought back to Belgrade and the first workshop I'd taught with Mystery. I remembered two cool exotic options, Sasha skipping down the street with his first email close, and Jerry's sense of humor. I loved those guys. I cared about them. I wanted them to get laid. I emailed them for months afterward, checking on their progress. Now I looked around the living room and saw neediness and hunger and desperation. Bald guys with goatees, miniature and supersized versions of myself, asked me to pose for photos with them. Good-looking guys who could have been models clamored for advice on hairstyles and clothes to buy, and then asked me to pose for photos with them. Two Korean brothers at the convention, both virgins, brought their sister along. She was a quiet 19-year-old, with large impish eyes, gumdrop breasts, and a hip-hop fashion sense. Thanks to her brothers, she knew everything about the game. When guys approached her with cocky funny lines, she told them, "Don't try that David D'Angelo stuff on me. I've read it all." She introduced herself as Min, and then asked me to pose for a photo with her. "I'm a big fan of your posts," she said. "You've read them?" I asked, shocked. "Yeah," she bit her lip. For my presentation, I brought in five of the girls I was dating. I ran routines on them, and then used them as a panel of experts to critique the clothing and body language of various wannabe players in the audience. I received a standing ovation. Afterward, I sat on our newly purchased blood-red couches, surrounded by Papa, Tyler Durden, and a few of their students. They were discussing the video of Mystery and I picking up Caroline and Carly. Somehow, Gunwich had gotten a hold of it and put it on the internet, shattering what was left of my anonymity. "It's so genius," Papa was saying. "Tyler Durden has broken down everything style does to a science. He calls it style mogging." "What's that?" one of the students asked. "It's a type of frame control," Tyler Durden replied. "A frame is an NLP term. It is the perspective through which one sees the world. Whoever's frame, or subjective reality, is the strongest, tends to dominate in interaction. Style has all these really subtle ways of keeping control of the frame and getting people to qualify themselves to him. He makes sure that the focus is always on him. I'm writing a post about it. That's awesome, I said. Suddenly, Papa, Tyler Durden, and the students laughed. That's one of the things you do, Papa said. Tyler's writing about that. What? I just said awesome. That's because I think it's hilarious. Seriously, I can't wait to read it. They all laughed again. Evidently, I was style-mogging them. See, Tyler Durden said, you'll use curiosity as a frame to get rapport and make the other person lose social value. When you show approval like that, it makes you the authority and makes other people want to seek your validation. We're teaching that. Shit, I replied. Now, every time I say something, people are going to think I'm running a real social dynamics routine. They all laughed again. And that's when I realized that I was fucked. Everything Tyler Durden was writing about wasn't anything I'd learned in the community. That was all part of me and who I really was. And even though he had my intentions wrong, that was his frame, his way of looking at the world. He had my mannerisms down. He was taking the building blocks of my personality, giving them names, and turning them into routines. He was going to take my soul and spread it all over the Sunset Strip. That night, the Puas from the convention met at the Saddle Ranch. As soon as I walked in, I saw the Korean brothers with their sister, Min. After talking for a few minutes, Min said she was tired and asked me to walk her back to Project Hollywood. I understood the subtext. As we ambled back to the mansion arm in arm, she talked about her older brothers and their difficulty learning the game. They're real protective and get mad when I go on dates, she said, but I think they're jealous because they're not going on dates themselves. When we returned to Project Hollywood, I brought her to the jacuzzi. My last boyfriend was the sweetest guy, and he did everything for me, she went on. But I didn't like him. He got on my nerves. After I started reading all my brother's pickup stuff, I understood why I wasn't attracted to him or any of the other guys at school. They're all so boring. They don't understand cocky funny. I stripped down to my boxers and jumped in the water. She joined me in her bra and panties. She was thin and delicate like a marionette. I took her hands and pulled her toward me. She straddled my legs, and we began making out. I took her bra off and put her gumdrops in my mouth. Then I carried her naked and dripping to my bedroom, put on a condom, and slowly entered her. There was no LMR. By looking up to me so much, her brothers had driven her into my arms. She was my first groupie, and she would not be my last. This whole Pua thing was getting too big. With so many new competing seduction businesses aggressively marketing their services online, the community was growing exponentially, especially in Southern California, where the Sunset Strip was transforming before our eyes. No woman was safe. Workshops of 15 people wandered the street like gangs. Bands of former students patrolled every club, the Standard, Dublin's, the Saddle Ranch, Miyagi's. When the bars closed at 2 a.m., they'd invade males, walking up and down the aisles, seating themselves at any table with a female. They carted women into the house by the truckload. And they were all using my material. They were running around style-mogging and delivering the best friends test like they were Spanish flies. In every club I saw their shaven heads, their diabolical goatees, their shoes that looked like the pair I'd bought in the Beverly Center a week before. Mini-me's were everywhere, and there was nothing I could do about it. Chapter 7. I can't just tell students not to come to your workshop. Mystery and Papa were arguing again. You book too many students, Mystery said, throwing his hands up, exasperated. It's not fun for me, and it's not fair to them. You're making my business look bad. Papa's voice was stuffy with pent-up frustration. Fine, Mystery yelled. Then take my name off your website. Our business relationship is through. I don't want anything to do with real social dynamics. It was a doomed partnership to begin with. The next day, Herbal offered to be Mystery's business partner. It seemed as if he'd been laying low the whole time, waiting for his moment to get involved in the pickup business. Since he'd arrived at the house, he hadn't been with a single woman besides Seema, an ex-MLTR of Mystery's, who had moved to Los Angeles from Toronto. When Mystery and Seema started getting on each other's nerves shortly after her arrival in town, she started showing IOIs to Herbal. Instead of getting upset, Mystery sat Herbal down and told him everything he needed to do to sarge her. Seema and Erbil ended up fooling around that night. Afterward, it only served to strengthen Mystery and Erbil's friendship, but they seemed unaware of something that everyone else around them realized. A bad precedent was being set. Once Erbil started working for Mystery, we truly became a house divided. There was real social dynamics in Captain Papa's room and Mystery Method, which had the rest of the house. I was the only person under the roof who wasn't on the payroll of either, but that didn't stop Papa from snubbing me, along with Mystery and Erbil. I was guilty by association. If Papa and I happened to bump into each other, as he snuck around the back of the house, he'd walk past with a brusque hello, staring vacantly through me. He wasn't angry. He was just operating on some sort of program that didn't include me. The curious thing is, most robots don't program themselves. In the meantime, every single rule we had laid down at the house meeting, requiring approval for guests, giving the house a percentage of seminar money, not hitting on another Pua's woman, was bypassed and ignored. We had no idea how many students, sergers, and instructors Papa was packing into his room. They scurried around the house like peacocked rats. We didn't even bother to lock the doors anymore. His latest recruits were two interns who looked like younger versions of himself. No one knew their names. They were known simply as the Mini Papas. The Mini Papas were just as cold to me as Papa was, but they were constantly around. They watched my every move, as if it were an assignment they'd been given. Sometimes I'd see them sitting at Mel's Diner with Tyler Durden. The three of them would be talking about me. He'll reposition his body to steer the conversation in his direction. He'll leave at times to show scarcity. If you make a joke, he exaggerates it to steal the glory. If someone asks him to do a routine, he'll say, in the field, so that it's on his time and the person appreciates it more. They weren't criticizing me. They were trying to model me. Yet oddly, they never hung out with me as friends. They just wanted to listen and absorb and take notes. It was dehumanizing. But then again, no one in that house seemed entirely human to begin with. I needed to get out of there. Fortunately, Rolling Stone wanted me to tackle another tough subject. Her name was Courtney Love. The interview was scheduled to take place for 1 hour at the Virgin Records office in New York. Courtney was at the peak of her infamy at the time. That week, she'd bared her breast to David Letterman on network TV, appeared on the front page of the New York Post with one of her mammaries in the mouth of a stranger outside Wendy's, and been arrested for allegedly hitting a fan in the head with a microphone stand during a concert. Then there were the pending drug charges hanging over her head and her loss of custody of her daughter. The Rolling Stone story was the first interview she'd agreed to do since all the trouble went down. When I met her at Virgin, Courtney wore a black dress with a sash wrapped tastefully around her torso. Her lips were painted red and full. Considering the number of ugly tabloid headlines featuring her name, Courtney looked good. Pale, thin, statuesque. Soon, however, the sash was loose and dangling behind her like a tail, and the lipstick was smeared. It seemed like a metaphor for her life, constantly unraveling. "If you guys are waiting for me to die, you're going to have to wait a long time," she began. I was the press. I was the enemy. My grandmother didn't die until she was 102. This is what Pua's called a bitch shield. It was nothing personal, just a protective mechanism. I couldn't let it faze me. I had to get rapport and show her I was human, not just another blood-sucking journalist. "I still have nightmares about my grandmother," I told her, "because the last time I had the chance to see her alive, we had plans to go to the Art Institute of Chicago, and I blew her off because I wanted to sleep late." We fluffed for a while about families. She didn't like hers very much. Now we were getting somewhere. As the interview continued, I hit the hook point. She looked up at me and the walls came down. Her face flushed, the muscles in her cheeks clamped, and the tears started dripping. "I need to be saved," she sobbed. "You need to save me." Now we had rapport. Rapport equals trust plus comfort. When our hour was up, Courtney suggested exchanging phone numbers. She said she'd call me later that night to continue the interview. I was relieved because an hour-long discussion in a record company office wouldn't have made for a very interesting profile. At least Tom Cruise had taken me motorcycle riding and Scientology sightseeing. That night, I met some old college friends at Soho House, a private club in the Warehouse District of Manhattan. I hadn't seen them since I'd joined the community, and they hardly recognized me. They spent half an hour discussing how awkward and introverted I used to be. Then their conversation turned to work and movies. I tried to contribute, but I had trouble focusing on the words. They just floated into my ear and accumulated there uselessly like wax. I felt like I didn't fit in with them anymore. Fortunately, an Amazonian woman with tree trunk thighs and a lethal boob job soon stumbled past the table. She was a foot taller than me and somewhat drunk. "Have you seen a girl in a black cowboy hat?" she asked in a staccato Swedish accent. "Hang out with us," I said. "We're more fun than your friends." It was a line I'd learned from David D'Angelo, and it worked. My friends looked on in shock as she sat down and asked for a cigarette. For the rest of the night, the Amazon and I talked. Every now and then, she'd drag me to the bathroom, where I'd watch her inhale cocaine like a human dustbuster. "Do you watch Sex and the City?" she asked as we left the bathroom for the third time that night. "Sometimes," I told her. "I just got a pearl," she said with pride. "That's great." I had no idea what a pearl was. "It's cool," she said, "with those little beads." "Oh, the beads. Those things are great." I was totally confused, but I liked listening to her, enjoying the mismatch between her harsh accent and her spongy lips. Maybe she was talking about anal beads. Good for her. I stopped and leaned against the wall of the corridor we were walking through. "How good of a kisser are you, on a scale of 1 to 10? "I'm a 10, she said. "I like soft, slow teasing kisses. I hate it when someone rams their tongue down my throat." "Yeah, I had a girlfriend who did that. It was like making out with a cow." "I give amazing blowjobs," she said. "Respect." That one-word answer had taken me months to figure out. Some women like to make extremely sexual comments after meeting a man. It was a shit test. If the guy became uncomfortable, he failed. However, if he took the bait and got excited or said something sexual in response, he also failed. After watching the British comedian Ali G, I discovered the solution. Just look her in the eye, nod approvingly, and, with a slight smile creeping across her face, say, "respect," in a smart-ass tone. I had responses now for nearly every challenge a woman could throw my way. But this was hardly a challenge. It was fool's mate. My job was simply to not do anything wrong. I fell silent and did what the Puas call triangular gazing, looking slowly from her left eye to her right eye, and then to her lips to create suggestive sexual tension. She threw herself against me. The next thing she did was ram her tongue down my throat like a cow. Then she pulled away. "Talking about kissing got me excited," she said. "Let's get out of here," I replied, peeling myself off the wall. We took the elevator downstairs and hailed a cab. She gave the driver an address in the East Village. I guess we were going to her place. She straddled me in the back seat and pulled a heavy breast out of her tank top. I guess I was supposed to suck it. We arrived at her house and climbed the stairs to her apartment. She turned on a lamp, which cast a dull brown glow over the room, and slipped the Rolling Stones' Goat Head Soup into her stereo. "I'm just going to put my pearl on," she told me. "I can't wait," I said, and I couldn't. As I lay there, I realized I'd forgotten to say goodbye to my friends. In fact, I'd ignored them all night. Sarging had dropped a polyester curtain between me and my past. But when my new friend emerged in her pearl, I decided, in the heat of the moment, that it was worth it. The pearl wasn't anal beads at all. It was a pair of panties with an exposed crotch and a chain of small metal balls connecting the front side to the back. She'd probably left the house that night, hoping to find someone to take home to show it off to. Obliging, I rubbed the balls gently against her labia and her clit. I figured that was what it was for, though I wasn't really sure, because a minute later, the chain of balls snapped off the underwear. It dangled between her legs like a tampon string. So much for her new pearl. "I'm going to change," she said. She didn't seem upset. Inhaling an 8-ball of cocaine will do that to someone. She reemerged in knee-high black leather boots, lay down on the bed, and took another dustbuster snort from a burgundy vial of coke. Then she lifted the vial over her chest and tapped a small pile of powder onto the crest of her left breast. I'm not a fan of drugs. Part of being a Pua is learning to control your own state, so you don't need alcohol or drugs to have a good time. But if I were ever going to do cocaine, now would be the time. Every woman is different in bed. Each has her own tastes and quirks and fantasies. And someone's surface appearance never accurately indicates the raging storm or dead calm that lies beneath. Reaching that moment of passionate truth, of surrender, honesty, revelation, was my favorite part of the game. I loved seeing what new person emerged in bed, and then talking with that new person after our mutual orgasms. I guess I just like people. I leaned over her breast and plugged my left nostril. I was really dreading this. I didn't want to be up all night, and I had a feeling that coke wasn't good for a gentleman's staying power. Not that I was a gentleman. And then the phone rang. My phone. "I have to get this," I told her. I jumped up, spilling her fairy dust all over the sheets, and grabbed my cell. I had a feeling I knew who was calling. "Hey, can you come over?" It was Courtney Love. "See if you can get some acupuncture needles in Chinatown, the big ones that hurt the most, and get some alcohol and cotton swabs." Chapter 8. "This one's for the gallbladder," Courtney Love said as she slammed an acupuncture needle into my leg. "Shouldn't this be done by a licensed professional?" "I've been doing this since I was young," she replied. "But you're the first person I've done it to in a while." She wiggled the needle around. "Tell me when you feel it." "There." An electric shock to the leg. "Okay, enough." My scheduled one-hour interview with Courtney Love had turned into a surreal slumber party. Outside of food runs, I didn't leave her Chinatown loft for 72 hours. It was 5,000 square feet, with nothing in it but a bed, a television, and a couch. Dressed down in a t-shirt and sweatpants, she was in hiding. From the paparazzi, from her manager, from the government, from the bank, from a man, from herself. I was stripped down to my boxers on her couch, with a dozen needles sticking out of me. Over time, the floor around her bed grew dense with crumbs, cigarette butts, clothing, food wrappers, needles, and root beer bottles. Meanwhile, the color of her fingers and toes changed from flesh to blackened ash. She was too scared even to answer her phone, in case someone called her, she said, with some bullshit news about some fucking thing. It was just the two of us, journalist and rock star, player and playette. She put Boogie Nights into her DVD player, then climbed into her bed and threw a stained blanket over herself. "I always ask the guy I'm dating, what's your biggest fear?" she said. "My last boyfriend said it's drifting, which he's doing now. The video director I'm currently obsessed with said failure, and I'm living mine. It's loss of power." Of all the problems in Courtney's life, the one that seemed to consume her most was romantic. The video director wasn't returning her calls. It was a problem common to all women, no matter what they look like or how famous they were. "I have a theory," she said. "You have to sleep with a guy 3 times for him to fall in love with you. And I only slept with him 2. I need 1 more night to get him." "If you want to get him," I said, "read The Art of Seduction by Robert Greene. It'll give you some strategy." She stubbed her cigarette out on the floor. "I need all the help I can get." The Art of Seduction was classic Pua reading material, along with Greene's other book, The 48 Laws of Power. For the former, Greene studied the greatest seductions of history and literature in search of common themes. His book classified different types of seducers, among them rakes, ideal lovers, and naturals. Different types of targets, the drama queen, the rescuer, the crushed star, and different types of approaches, all of which jived with community philosophy. Approach indirectly, send mixed signals, appear to be an object of desire, isolate the victim. "How do you know about that book?" she asked. "I've spent the last year and a half hanging out with the world's greatest pickup artists." She sat up in her bed. "Tell me, tell me, tell me," she squealed like a schoolgirl. Talking about pickup was better than the alternative. Whenever the discussion veered toward her legal, media, and custody problems, her eyes filled with tears. She listened rapt as I told her about the community and Project Hollywood. It wasn't easy to have a serious conversation with a dozen acupuncture needles sticking out of my body. "I want to meet them," she said excitedly. "Do you think they're as good as Warren Beatty?" "I don't know. I've never met him." Courtney climbed out of bed and rubbed patchouli oil around the needles in my feet, legs, and chest. "Let me tell you, he's smooth. I would love to know how he operates." "He's great. He once called me and said, 'Hey, it's me,' as if I should have known who it was. Then he tried to convince me to come over to his house that night. When I finally said yes, he laughed and said he was in Paris. It's a total mindfuck. He'll blow his nose and then hand the dirty tissue to his date. It was a neg. Warren Beatty negged women. Every PUA, whether he's aware of it or not, uses the same principles. The difference between those in the community and lone wolves like Warren Beatty, when he was single, Brett Ratner, and David Blaine, is that we name our techniques and share our information. I don't know what this director's problem is, Courtney was saying. I have a magic pussy. If you fuck me, you become a king. I'm a kingmaker. Translation, if you fuck her, you become famous. She began pulling the needles out of my body. Relief. You have to get one in your head. It's the best feeling. Fumbling around the floor, Courtney grabbed a dirty needle. She aimed it just above my eye. No thanks. I've had enough for today. You gotta try it. It's great for the liver. My liver's fine, thanks. She dropped the needle back to the floor. Fine. I'm going out to get some Rice Krispie treats then. She wriggled out of her pink shirt and stood in front of me topless. These are natural breasts, but with a silicone lift, she said, hovering over me and revealing a scar underneath her left mammary. Do you know how much a shot of my tits is worth? $9,000. Then your financial problems are solved, I suggested. That won't even get me in the door at the lawyer's office, she snapped, slipping into a black and white baby doll dress. When she returned from the store, she was flush with excitement. She pulled a coffee cake out of her bag and split it in half, leaving a trail of crumbs behind her as she made for the safety of her bed. Let's make a bet, she said. What? I will bet you that I can get this director back. I doubt you can. If he's not returning your calls, he's not interested. He even denied he'd slept with me in the post. She handed me half of the coffee cake in her blackened fingers. But I'd like a challenge. Well, if you can get him back, you're a better pickup artist than I am. Then let's bet, she insisted. What are the stakes? If I can't get him back, I will give you a 1 week stand with me, wherever you want. I looked at her blankly. I was so taken aback by the notion that I had trouble processing the words. Or you can pick the middle name of my next child. It's your choice. Okay, but I have one condition. I get an hour of advice with each pickup artist you're living with. When it came time for me to leave her loft and catch my plane, Courtney climbed out of bed and kissed me goodbye. I just need to be fucked, she said as I waited for the elevator that would take me out of her loft. I just need a bossy guy to come here and fuck me. I knew I could have been that guy. The IOIs were there. But there's a PUA code of honor, there's a gambler's code of honor, and there's a journalist's code of honor, and having sex with her would have been violating all three. What I had told my natural friend Dustin several months ago in my apartment really was true. Learning pickup had enriched so much more than just my sex life. The skills I had amassed in the community made me a much better interviewer than I'd ever been. I discovered just how good when I was assigned an interview with Britney Spears. Chapter 9. Was there a lot of pressure on you while making this album? Britney Spears. What now? Was there a lot of pressure from yourself or the label to have a major hit this time around? I have no idea. You have no idea? I have no idea. I heard you did a track with a DFA that wasn't included on your new CD. Why was that? What's the DFA? They're two producers from New York, James Murphy and Tim Goldsworthy, who call themselves the DFA. Does that ring a bell? Yeah, maybe they did something. My interview with Britney Spears was going nowhere. I looked at her, crossing her legs and fidgeting on the hotel room couch next to me. She didn't give a shit. I was just an amount of time blocked off on her calendar, and she was tolerating it, poorly. Her hair was tucked under a white Kangol hat, and her thighs pushed at the seams of her faded blue jeans. She was one of the most desired women in the world. But in person, she looked like a corn-fed southern sorority girl. She had a beautiful face, lightly and perfectly touched with makeup, but there was something masculine about her. As a sexual icon, she was unintimidating and, I imagined, lonely. A gear slammed down in my head. There was only one way to save this interview. I had to sarge her. No matter what country I was in, or what age or class or race of woman I was talking to, the game always worked. Besides, I had nothing to lose by gaming Britney Spears. The interview couldn't get any more boring. Maybe I'd even get a decent quote I could actually print. I folded my list of questions and put them in my back pocket. I had to treat her like any club girl with attention deficit disorder. The first move was to hook her attention. "I'll tell you something about yourself that other people probably don't know," I began. "People sometimes see you as shy or bitchy off stage, even though you aren't." "Totally," she said. "Do you want to know why?" "Yeah." I was creating what's called the yes ladder, capturing her attention by asking questions that require an obvious affirmative answer. "I'm watching your eyes when you talk, and every time you think, they go down and to the left. That means you're a kinesthetic person. You're someone who lives in her feelings." "Oh my God," she said, "that's totally true." Of course it was. It was one of the value-demonstrating routines I developed. The eye goes to one of seven different positions when someone thinks. Each position means the person is accessing a different part of their brain. As I taught her how to read different types of eye movements, she clung to every word. Her legs uncrossed, and she leaned in toward me. The game was on. "I didn't know this," she said. "Who told you this?" I wanted to tell her, a secret society of international pickup artists. "It's something I observed from doing lots of interviews," I answered. "In fact, by watching the direction people's eyes move when they speak, you can tell